the experience of the surgeon, as we've said a few times, this is universal for all of us, but the discussion around it doesn't quite match the frequency of which this happens, within the profession, but certainly outside of the profession. And one can see that if we as a college of surgeons, quote unquote college, aren't very good at discussing it amongst ourselves, what hope do the outside world have? And I think you've got this very good concept of heroes versus villains when looked from the outside in. I'll get you to elaborate more on that when thinking about perception from the outside world, be that the public, relatives, or the media.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think one of the things that's helpful to explore a little bit is that there are very different perspectives coming to bear on the episode when a mistake happens. And yeah, I mean, I think I would love to find ways to develop a more nuanced conversation in the media and the general public, because I think at the moment the stories that you see, there are two stories about surgeons essentially. There's the hero story, amazing superhero surgeons who develop literally cutting edge techniques that are saving the world and, you know, overcoming adversity to, you know, sort of single-handedly save people, if you like. So newspapers like the hero's journey type story, and that is newsworthy, and they love the villain story, that when a mistake happens, the patient is a victim of abuse essentially, and the surgeon is the abuser essentially, is the sort of narrative that it's kind of a pantomime type approach. There's heroes and villains, and these are the villains to boo and hiss at, basically. And in terms of some nuanced conversation and discussion of the reality, I don't think we see a lot of that. And I mean, I said at the beginning, it's universal. I think a little study we did showed that 98% of trainees had made a mistake as the principal surgeon. And that was from ST3 all the way through. So I suspect it's 100% by the end of training. And there was a big study. I think it was about 7,500 consultant level surgeons in the States that they did a few years ago, which found that 10% had made a major error in the operating theatre within the last 3 months. So if you look at that over the cumulative over a career. And major error was the wording they used. So this is not one or two outliers and bad apples that need to be struck off. This is at the heart of surgical practice. And then there are other perspectives which we need to think about. So there's the sort of surgical cultural perspective on it, which tends to look at it as a sort of technical failure. And we have M&M meetings, which when they work well, can be good ways of learning from each other and moving things forwards. But they're definitely not, in my experience, somewhere where people come and say, well, this happened and I feel like this, and this is the effect it's having on me personally, and this sort of stuff, really. That's not what those meetings are about. And they can be quite toxic in terms of the culture there, in terms of blame and so on. And then you've got the sort of managers coming to it, where it's more of a risk management issue, and what are the implications for this, and have we ticked all the boxes to make sure that we're seen to do the right thing? I think in society at large, you've got a perspective of hubris, which I think is very, very much in this story, that pride comes before a fall. And I've had quite a few conversations now with, I mean, again, people in the media, but they feel like they're representing the public view that well, these stuck-up surgeons, what can they expect? They're arrogant and they get what's coming to them, basically. Which is quite hard to listen to when you're talking about these big effects that we've been talking about today. But I think what I would come back to people about that with is thinking about, why do surgeons have that sort of traditional reputation? And I think some of it is related to maladaptive coping strategies for dealing with just what we're talking about, that people develop a thick skin, they develop a wall, their empathy can be diminished, and all the other things one associates with the sort of archetypal traditional bad surgeon, if you like, I think can be seen as maladaptive coping mechanisms. And then for the patient, there can even be a moral element to it that, Nancy Behringer talks about this in a book called After Harm, that the patient can be experiencing this as an actual moral wrong. You know, it's not just, oh yeah, something happened to me. It's the mistake, and often what happens after the mistake can create huge problems. But coming back to the clinician, their perspective on it can be devastating psychologically, spiritually, physically, mentally. So we've got all these different perspectives, which can make it hard, for instance, to bridge the gap between harmed patients and hurting clinicians, which is another bit that I've tried to explore in the workshops that I've been setting up.
Yeah, I think a few things to unpick. Harmed patient, hurting clinician is a fantastic phrase that encapsulates what's going on at the time of a complication or something going wrong. Because no surgeon, no clinician usually comes in wanting to cause harm. And often the repercussions to them emotionally, which understandably is not at the forefront of our minds, because obviously we put the patient at the center, as we should, but it's also important to recognize that. And I think one quote that we'll talk about, when you also said some of the maladaptive coping mechanisms might underpin some of these behaviors, it sort of made me think, and we've discussed this previously around Renee Larisse's quote. It's one thing that since I've seen it, I've sort of written it down and sort of framed it and put it in an office where I can read the entire quote out if you'd like, because I think it's just really good to underpin some of this discussion. And it's, essentially, it says that every surgeon carries within himself or herself a small cemetery where from time to time he or she goes to pray, a place of bitterness and regret where he must look for an explanation for his or her failures. And that just speaks to some of these inner scars that we talk about that people carry that underpin some of their behaviors and decisions. And that leads us to the impact on the clinician itself when we talk about burnout, dropout, etc. It's just to get your views on that quote, which I know, you know, you reflect on and have views on Larisse's quote.
Yeah, I believe Larisse was one of the most prominent surgeons of French surgery in the 20th century. He was at the forefront of dealing with the sorts of horrific injuries that came out of the First World War and then the Second World War, at the forefront of that huge expansion of surgical practice as a result of the injuries they were having to deal with, and hugely respected and at the forefront of the profession. And I think it's really good to think about that. I haven't got it framed in my office, I have to say, but maybe I should have. It's that sort of early to mid 20th century, but this is not a historical thing, I think is what I would say about it. So there was recently an address you can see online. It was at the 2023 National Meeting for the Association for Academic Surgery in the States, and there was an address by the president there. So this sort of keynote presidential address, which I'd recommend everybody watching, it's a surgeon called Carrie Cunningham. And the title of the talk is Removing the Mask. And it's not an easy watch, I have to say, but she comes to this national conference as the president and is completely open about the mental health issues that she's struggled with through her surgical practice and the impact she's seen on other surgeons of this sort of problem, and the friend who committed suicide. And there's been a recent editorial, I think it was in the British Journal of Surgery, seeing this as like a turning point in terms of how in surgery we need to be grappling with these mental health issues, which are they're there throughout surgery, and we need to bring them into the open.
Yeah, and the era of turning a blind eye to this, essentially, yes. Not false bravado, but basically suggesting that, you know, we are not human, cold-hearted, and have no feelings or emotions, and these things don't affect us. We just, as one of my colleagues, ex-trainer, would say, get back on the horse and get on with it. That leads to compartmentalization of your feelings, and eventually at some point you lose the ability to cope, and then extreme decisions are made in terms of, you know, we've talked about burnouts, dropouts, suicide, and those sort of impacts that it could have on clinicians. Whereas there's an alternative where, and you talk about this very well in terms of surviving versus thriving and learning and then thriving, you know, and how there's an alternative approach to this.
Yeah, so I think those categories originate from a paper by Scott, Susan Scott, at the University of Missouri, and others who wrote the paper, again, from qualitative research with surgeons reflecting on mistakes that they've made. And yes, she looks at the natural history of mistakes within surgery, and in the long term looks at these three categories of dropping out, surviving and thriving. And yeah, we've been touching on those, the dropping out, the people lost to the profession. I spoke earlier about the, it was actually a TED talk that Lilani Schweitzer gave in the aftermath of the death of her son, which again, I would very highly recommend people watch. It's on YouTube, Truth and Compassion. But she talks very movingly about the effects that she sees on the clinicians who are involved. As a bereaved mother, she could see the effects that it was having on the clinicians and how they dropped out. And some of those clinicians never practiced again as a result of what happened to her son. So that is a definite category that we need to look at. And that sort of downward spiral that you mentioned earlier, I think is particularly related to shame as a result of this. And we tend to talk about guilt and shame and sort of think about them as being a little bit synonymous. But I think it's helpful to differentiate, and one helpful, I think, way of differentiating between those two is guilt says I did a bad thing, and that can be inappropriate if actually you were practicing perfectly reasonably and something happened but you didn't do anything wrong. That's not something that's good to have guilt about. But where we do make a mistake, it is actually a constructive thing to have guilt, and can lead us towards constructive action to improve what went wrong, to improve ourselves, and so on and so forth, as opposed to shame, which says I am a bad person. So it's generalizing what happened to the entirety of who you are. And I think that avoiding that feeling of shame is vital for avoiding this downward spiral into dropping out, and also avoiding this idea of surviving, which I think is still a common outcome, that people are surviving and they're putting a brave face on things, and they've taken on board the get back on the horse, man up, feel free to cope, any of these sorts of approaches, which I think have been some of the traditional approaches to this situation. I mean I think that being in surviving mode, survival, is related to these sort of common stereotypes of surgeons. But it's a sort of brittle hardness, really. Whereas there are certainly ways of thriving, which is not to take a sort of simplistic approach. But I think any expert that you talk to, but any expert surgeon you talk to, they are expert because of their failures, as well as because of all the successes that they've had. But it's what they've done with those failures. So part of that is a mindset of what you bring to it. So there's this idea of growth mindset, that you're not trying to do it perfect first time, that no expert is born as an expert, and that you're growing through everything that happens, and that actually it is, as Malcolm says, it is inevitable that you'll make mistakes. And I'm not saying that in a flippant way, but it is part of developing as a surgeon. I think the ability to forgive ourselves is really important, which again is the sort of guilt, shame part of it, really. I think what we can learn thinking about what we can learn from it, thinking about what we can teach other people about it. I mean, certainly from my point of view, if I can tell people about something that happened to me in a way that means that they won't get into that situation, that helps me to find some meaning in what happened. And I think there is this idea, again, going back to mindset of a sort of creative and innovation mindset to surgical practice. You alluded to the fact that I've been doing quite a lot of work with the arts of various sorts in exploring this and exploring other aspects of our practice. And within the arts, mistakes are not seen as the enemy. They're seen as the heart of creative practice. Now, we can't, as surgeons, turn up to the operating theatre and say, yes, I welcome every mistake that's going to come, and that's all good because something good might come out of it, type of thing. That wouldn't be right. And yet, many, many innovations I can think of in my personal practice, but certainly in terms of published practice around surgery and biographies and so on, come through mistakes. The one that's most salient to me is there's a chap called Sam Rosen, who was an ENT surgeon in the mid-20th century, and his instruments I still use every time I'm in the operating theatre doing ear surgery. But he made a mistake when he was doing an operation for hearing loss, where he was too rough with the stapes and thought he might have avulsed it, but essentially sort of hit it with an instrument and, you know, was rough with it in a way that could have caused complete deafness for the patient that he was trying to improve their hearing. But actually, he was doing it under local anaesthetic, and the patient suddenly said, "Oh, I can hear, fantastic. You know, you've sorted it out." As opposed to the 3-4 hour operation that he was planning to do on this patient. And again, fascinating story, but he then developed this into a technique which then went on to cure millions literally around the world of deafness for otosclerosis by mobilizing the stapes, which is not something people have been doing before. But it was him making a mistake in the operating theater that allowed him to develop this new technique and this whole new approach to stapes surgery. And I've come across that with people I worked with as a trainee who told me about why their technique was in a certain way. And I now found that in my own practice. Either I made a mistake in the past or a trainee made a mistake when they were working with me. And in sorting that out, I found a better way of doing the operation. So I think that can also be part of this sort of thriving approach to expertise developing through growth.
Yeah. And it's useful to continue to spread that message in terms of, you know, the three arms that you describe and how one can hope to achieve thriving out of mistakes rather than either burnout or that constant state of survival, which, as you say, most of us surgeons tend to find ourselves. One of the final elements of the impact on clinicians I thought we'll touch on before we move to the next bit that brings it all together is something that's very common. And as humans, we do it, but particularly as surgeons, we do it. There is the internal monologue that we all have where you know yourself inside and out, but when you look across the room, you only know the other person's outside. And so it's very easy for us to compare our insides with the outside fronts of others, which at a time of self-capitulation or self-criticism just increase or accelerates that spiral downwards even more. And that's one thing that classically happens when a mistake has happened, where you sort of think to yourself, and that sort of facilitates the feeling of shame, blame, and just the negative spiral. What are your thoughts around that human and surgical nature to compare insides to the outside fronts of others?
Yeah. I agree with everything you're saying there. It's interesting, the talk by Carrie Cunningham that I was talking about earlier on, it's called Removing the Mask. And yes, mostly we wear a mask even when we're not in the operating theatre, not a physical blue mask, but a mask nevertheless. And I think we need to. I think we all present a front in different bits. I talked about the compartmentalisation and opening those compartments of life. I hope I'm the same person when I'm in the operating theatre as when I'm at home. But the nature of the role demands a different front. And actually, I find it needs a different front in the operating theatre, a different front in outpatients, a different front if you're in the emergency department with somebody with stridor and acute airway obstruction that needs sorting out now. So we do have this aspect of the front the patients need from us, the front that our colleagues need from us as often leaders of the clinical team. So I think that is inevitable, but we have to be able to see beyond that and see that actually, yes, we see ourselves as we really are, and we see all the flaws and mistakes and difficulties, and it's healthy to find ways for people to see beyond the external front because it helps them. I mean, there was a very good paper I came across years ago talking about how consultants need to find ways in the operating theatre of showing some of the thought processes while you're doing an operation. There are some operations which are basically just steps 1 to 10, and you just do the same steps 1 to 10. But there are many operations where actually there's a lot going on in your head during the operation, certainly the majority of the surgery that I do, that you're trying to work out on the fly as you go, where are we going with this? And actually, there's an inner monologue in my head constantly in terms of, oh, what's going on here? And is that that? No, I don't think it is. No, I think we're fine. And this constant monologue. Now, if I was to just voice that inner monologue in theatre, I think that would be very unhelpful, because all people would hear is this constant doubt and, you know, okay, well, I don't think I've cut through that, but I think we're okay. And that's unhelpful. But having some way of people going behind the front and the mask to say, you know, to the trainee, okay, let's stop for a minute. I've got a few queries in my mind at the moment. And, you know, I think this is going to be the right way forward, but actually we might need to do this, or we might need to do that. And rather than just coming across as much as we can as, you know, somebody who knows all the answers, knows exactly what to do, it's all very straightforward and we just work through it, which is kind of the front that we would like to give the majority of the time, that this image of the swan that's serenely confident and competent on the surface, and then hidden underneath are all the flailing legs trying to keep you going. I think trainees don't necessarily need to see the flailing legs, but they need to see a little bit of the fact that there's some work going on to keep things afloat, basically. So yeah, I think it is helpful to try and find ways to share some of those things.
I think it'll also help those who are comparing their insides to your version of the outside front. So definitely helpful. Just as we come to the end of the podcast then, I thought one way we bring this all together is making sense of what's happened. And there's the poem Frozen, which I hope you'd read out an extract for us as a way of reflection. But I thought prior to you doing that, you set the scene and the podcast will end with the poem being read, and we can go away and sort of have the lasting impression of the words and reflect on that ourselves. So Frozen is a poem you've written.
Yeah, no, great. So this is very much something that started as an image. It started off with a photograph that I took on the outskirts of the village that I live in. We tend to get a lot of rain and just dismal weather in the winter around here in Devon, as opposed to sort of hard frosts and things. But a few years ago, we did have a particularly hard frost after rain. And I took the dog up across the fields with my camera with me. And I was particularly struck by an image I came across, which was some barbed wire. And the rain had fallen on the barbed wire and then had frozen solid. So you could see this sort of greenish tinge of this barbed wire shining through this thick ice that had formed, and the icicles that had formed on the barbed wire. And this poem came out of reflecting on that image and thinking about some of the stuff that we've just been talking about, putting those bits together. So, yeah, this is a poem called Frozen. Is each failure wrapped like a wire round your heart? of the cold, bitter tears that you've hidden inside turned to verglas, a thick coat of rime which deadens the barbs and freezes the hurt. Bound in the graveyard's wintry embrace, do you long, as I do, for the coming of spring, for the soft, healing waters that summer should bring, yet fear all the memories entombed in the ice? I've toiled in that acre and carry the scars, watched as the bramble and hawthorn have grown, but I've seen them both blossom with newly washed stars and bear precious fruit from this blessed hollow ground, in the hands of the one who can wipe all those tears and lift from your brow that cruel, thorny crown.